All right, well, good morning. Happy Father's Day. Here is the difference between Mother's Day and Father's Day. All right, so when Josh was saying that the Brink kids had to stay in with the sermon today, and he said Wendell had a rich sermon, I chuckled. It's a strange subject, so he probably should have said, the Brink kids will stand today for a strange sermon, because it will be that. So if you were here a couple weeks ago, you'll remember that we spent the morning considering many of the issues that would be raised if Jude was citing apocryphal literature of his day. And the questions about all this are pretty significant, and so it seemed worthwhile to address them head on, which we did. And hopefully everyone found that material that we covered there to be informative and valuable and helpful. However, the sermon wasn't one of those where you were left with any specific marching orders, like, therefore, go do this or stop doing this. The application, rather, was simply that of getting a better understanding of what was going on in Jude's letter. And in many of our sermons here, that will be the primary application, to help us better understand a Bible passage or a book in the Bible or something God has revealed in His Holy Word. And how that is relevant to each person is going to be different, probably. For instance, answering the question about Enoch's prophecy and the squabble between the Archangel Michael and the devil might help to assure someone struggling with doubts about Jude's letter that we can actually trust its contents. That could be one example. And hopefully we all recognize this, and hopefully we are all on the same page, but sometimes reminders like this can be helpful, especially when we have visitors. And I bring it up because we have something quite similar going on today, a passage where you aren't going to be left with, I must now behave in a certain way, but more like, okay, I think I have a better grasp of what that verse might be saying and what it might not be saying. And that itself will be the application. And that understanding, hopefully, will contribute to the marching orders that will eventually come toward the end of this letter. In fact, like other letters in the New Testament, you often don't get the therefore do this part until further in, not until you get into the last half. Ephesians is a perfect example of this. The first half of the book, Paul does not stop after every paragraph to point out how the readers should apply everything he is explaining. He builds his theological case, and then eventually, after three chapters, he then says, therefore. And we basically have the same thing going on here in Jude's letter. You know, it is coming once we get to verses 20 to 23, but we're a bit of a ways from that. So in the meantime, we have some grunt work. We have to do the grunt work and follow the argument that Jude is making, and grunt work is a good way to describe what lies before us today. It's a rather tricky passage to navigate, and explaining it can be a little challenging. It was difficult to try to organize all this, and so I'm just asking you to do the best you can to stay alert and attentive, and to help with this, I'm going to be using a lot of slides, and fortunately, it's not a long message today, which should help as well. It's not short, but it's not long either. And visitors who are coming in partway through this series, you're going to be at somewhat of a disadvantage. And since we aren't giving away shotguns and cigars and F-150 trucks on Father's Day like we've done in previous years, if you doze off today, I'm not going to like yell at you or anything. That's just going to be your Father's Day gift, okay? Now, I am kidding on both of those points. All right, so let's open up to Jude's letter. Last week we covered verses 1 through 8, and I only had time to mention the rebellion of these angels that are referred to there in verse 6. And Jude uses them as an example of disobedience that was met with God's punishment. And because of time restraints, I didn't elaborate on what their sin actually entailed, choosing instead to save that discussion for today when we could spend more time on it. So all does this sound familiar? Okay, for those who are here, hopefully. So here's what Jude writes, and we're going to, if you can follow along with me, we're going to read it, and it's in context, starting back with verse 5. Now, I want to remind you, Jude writes, although you once fully knew it, that Jesus, who saved the people out of the land of Egypt, afterward destroyed those who did not believe. And the angels, who did not stay within their own position of authority, but left their proper dwelling, he has kept in eternal chains under gloomy darkness until the judgment of the great day. Just as Sodom and Gomorrah and the surrounding cities, which likewise indulged in sexual immorality and pursued unnatural desires, served as an example by undergoing a punishment of eternal fire. Yet in like manner, these people also, relying on their dreams, defile the flesh, reject authority, and blaspheme the holy ones. So Jude here presents three examples from the past where disobedience to God was met with the full force of a swift and sure judgment. All would be examples his readers would be familiar with. Each of them underscores not only a tragic loss, but also an enduring permanent loss. And Jude points out that these fake believers who have infiltrated their church, spreading a corrupt teaching of libertinism, that they can expect to experience the same fate. And this is the argument he is making here in this whole section that runs from verse 4 all the way to 19. And in this particular section here that we just read, the first of five warnings and condemnations, we have, again, the Israelites doubting God after he rescued them from Egypt, refusing to trust him. And the scriptures provide several examples of this. There's no unsettled questions about that. He refers to the cities of Sodom and Gomorrah, the nature of their sin. Again, this isn't a great mystery. And thirdly, the angels who left their, I'm getting this out of order, but also the angels who left their proper dwelling. But this one, unlike the other two, is a bit more puzzling. What exactly is Jude referring to? And so that's our project for this morning, to see if we can figure that out. That said, the case Jude is making here does not rise or fall in whether we can identify the exact nature of this sin or not. Jude has told us enough to make the point he wants us to get. They rebelled and they were punished. There is, of course, value in digging into this to see if we can discover the nature of that sin. But again, the point Jude makes still stands either way. One reason I want to spend time on it is because this passage is often the subject of a lot of discussion, even debate, and it would serve us well to be familiar with the issues involved with it and the different positions that have been taken, to be equipped to enter into those discussions. So we might think of this morning actually as kind of like an exercise in hermeneutics. There is value in learning both the conclusion and the means of how we get to that conclusion, even if that conclusion is, well, there is no conclusion, okay? So fair enough. All right, so let's start with what the difficulty here is. Let's just kind of spell this out. First, as mentioned earlier, Jude does not elaborate on this sin the angels have committed. He simply says that they did not stay within their own position of authority, but left their proper dwelling. This means that any speculation anyone might make about that has to be held with a light grip. This is not something to get dogmatic about. Secondly, We don't find anything in the Old Testament that uses this same kind of language when referring to the angels, or for that matter, to anyone or anything. Nothing here that we can definitely say, oh, look, Jude is talking about this. Now, there are speculations about a passage in Genesis 6, which we will get to, but these statements did not stay within their own position of authority and left their proper dwelling and are now kept in eternal chains and gloomy darkness, they're nowhere to be found in the Old Testament. And thirdly, verse 7 could actually be making a contribution to the identification of this sin. And the key word here is could. In fact, since verse 7 plays such a major role in this whole discussion, I want to go ahead and start with that, by looking at that and see what we can learn. And we're going to consider it from both the ESV and the NIV. And these two versions treat verse 7 a bit differently, and they, at least in this case, represent the differences that we would find in the other English translations. Okay? So starting with the ESV, just as Sodom and Gomorrah and the surrounding cities, which likewise indulged in sexual immorality and pursued unnatural desire, serve as an example by undergoing a punishment of eternal fire. Okay? So the words, which likewise indulged in sexual immorality and pursued unnatural desire, do they refer to the angels in the previous verse? If so, then the angel's sin would involve sexual immorality. That is, a pursuing something God has forbidden, something unnatural. And this is one way to read that passage. And from the sources that I consulted, there's nothing in the Greek that would prevent this interpretation. However, it is also possible that the statement underlined here on the screen could instead be referring to those cities surrounding Sodom and Gomorrah. So again, read it from that perspective. If so, then the passage is simply stating that the whole region reeked with the sin of homosexuality and that this sin is yet another example of open rebellion against God. Does everyone see the difference there? See how it could go either way? All right. Let's now consider the NIV. In a similar way, Sodom and Gomorrah and the surrounding towns gave themselves up to sexual immorality and perversion. All right? I didn't read the whole thing. They serve as an example of those who suffer the punishment of eternal fire. Okay, so this translation does not connect it to the surrounding cities at all. And while it could refer to the angels sinning sexually, such a suggestion in this translation is a bit weak. Rather, it favors much more the idea that the previous two examples, Israelites and angels, shared with Sodom and Gomorrah a common apostasy and therefore shared a common judgment, right? In a similar way. So together, all three situations serve as sobering examples for the reader to reflect upon. That would be the point there from the NIV. All right, so if you're following along, we basically have three possibilities. Jude could be saying, just as the angels pursued unnatural sexual relations, so did the people of Sodom and Gomorrah. Humans are off limits to angels. Men are off limits to other men. Or, just as Sodom and Gomorrah pursued unnatural sexual relations, so did their nearby cities. In this case, verse 7 would not be making any comment at all about the sin of the angels. Or, 3, just as the Israelites and angels disobeyed God by rejecting his divine order, so did the people of Sodom and Gomorrah. If so, then again, there would be nothing in verse 7 that would contribute to our understanding of what the angels did. So, to boil it all down, verse 7 is one or the other. Jude is identifying the sin of the angels, and that sin involves a sexual perversion, or Jude has moved on, and there's nothing in the sentence here in verse 7 that has anything to do with the angels. All right? You want to take a vote? All right, and this is part of the problem. Verse 7 could go either way, and so we have to be careful about trying to force something here. The popular view is that the angels sinned sexually, and verse 7 is used to support that case. Verse 7 might support that, but again, not necessarily. So that's the nature of the overall challenge here. Jude does not identify their sin in verse 6. There is no clear connection to anything in the Old Testament about this, and verse 7 isn't as helpful as what people would like to think. So that said, let's now consider the popular view, you might say kind of like the default position, and it would go something like this. You're probably familiar with it. The words forsaking their positions of authority and proper dwelling in verse 6 would be referring to a certain number of angels who left heaven, came to earth, took on human form, and united themselves sexually with human women. And here are some of the main arguments to support this view. It seems unlikely that Jude would use an example that his readers would not be familiar with. And this account of angels leaving heaven to unite with human women was quite popular in Jewish tradition and Jewish literature at the time Jude wrote this letter. References to the story can be found in several apocryphal books. Secondly, one such apocryphal book that devotes a great deal of attention to it is, of course, the Book of Enoch. And we can more or less assume from verses 14 and 15 that Jude is familiar with that book and is willing to draw from it. And it would seem likely, therefore, that Jude is also borrowing from it here in verse 6. In fact, these key expressions here in verse 6 are, those key expressions in verse 6 are found in the book of Enoch. In the book of Enoch, chapter 12, verse 4, abandoned the high heaven, the holy eternal place. Chapter 68, verse 28, they shall be bound with chains and imprisoned in their place of assembly. And chapter 103, verse 8, and into darkness and chains and a burning flame where there is harsh judgment. So the book of Enoch, as mentioned a couple weeks ago, tells the whole story of how 200 angels left heaven, married human women, brought evil and destruction into the world. They taught humans all sorts of detestable and wicked practices like witchcraft and sorcery and astrology, for instance, and how to perfect warfare using metal swords, and even introduced the whole art of cosmetics, everything from war paint to women wearing makeup. See how that all goes together. It goes on to explain that these marriages produced a race of giants, offspring who were half angel and half human, and that their souls upon their deaths became the demons and evil spirits that have and continue to possess victims through the centuries. Another major point to this position is that the Bible itself, it is claimed, gives an account of angels sinning sexually back in Genesis 6. And this is a passage that we have addressed in the past, and so let's just take some time now to look at it. When men began to increase in number on the earth and daughters were born to them, the sons of God saw that the daughters of men were beautiful and they married any of them they chose. Then the Lord said, my spirit will not contend with man forever, for he is mortal. His days will be 120 years. The Nephilim were on the earth in those days. And so afterward, when the sons of God went to the daughters of men and had children by them, they were the heroes of old, men of renown. The Lord saw how great man's wickedness on the earth had become, and that every inclination of the thoughts of his heart was only evil at the time. The Lord was grieved that he had made man on the earth, and his heart was filled with pain. So the Lord said, I will wipe mankind whom I have created from the face of the earth, men and animals and creatures that move along the ground and birds of the air, for I am grieved that I have made them. Okay, so according to this position, the sons of God, here in verse 2, are a reference to angelic beings. The Nephilim, these men of renown, are the offspring of these perverted unions. They are giants. And the reason for the great flood, the account of which immediately follows this passage, is because of the infiltration of these fallen angels. Mankind has become polluted both morally and biologically. And God needed to wipe them all out and start over. Okay, everyone following so far? And, of course, the other point to support this position is the wording of Jude 7. If you read it in a certain way, out of certain translations, it could seem to be saying that, like Sodom and Gomorrah, the angels pursued sexual relationships that were forbidden to them. So what do we make of this view? I mean, it's a pretty common one. Could there be anything to it? Well, it is certainly not unreasonable for Jude to refer to something his readers would have recognized, even something from the popular literature of his day. It is also not unreasonable to suggest that Jude's letter has been influenced by the book of Enoch, including verse 6. It is also not unreasonable to think that Jude also had Genesis 6 in mind and that he subscribed to this particular understanding about that passage. It's also not unreasonable to suggest that in verse 7, Jude is comparing the unnatural lusts of Sodom and Gomorrah to that of fallen angels. In fact, this whole position here, though it is a bit bizarre, is held to by a number of scholars and commentators that I've been relying on in my research here, and some of them are, you know, they're widely recognized as being responsible teachers of Scripture. Douglas Moo and Richard Bauckham and Thomas Schreiner and Peter Davids and Edward Blum and others. And so one would want to be a little reluctant to square off with them and challenge their conclusions. But there does appear to be some holes, or at least soft spots, to this position. Saying that something is not unreasonable is not the same as saying it is true. And when you consider the whole package, well, there are some things that I would find to be somewhat unreasonable, maybe not impossible, but certainly questionable. First of all, quite a bit of this case is built on a number of assumptions, and this cannot be overstated. Jude may not have even had the book of Enoch in mind here in verse 6. He makes no comment about that. This language about abandoning the high heaven and being bound with eternal chains and held in prison for the great judgment, those terms and phrases are not unique to the book of Enoch. They were common expressions in apocalyptic literature of that day, and Christians used those phrases. Along that line, Jude might not even had in mind the passage in Genesis 6. He doesn't tell us that he is referring to the events described there. He could be referring to something else entirely different. And verse 7, again, is inconclusive. It could be referring to the sexual immorality of the town surrounding Sodom and Gomorrah. Along with these assumptions is the questionable interpretation of Genesis 6. Is it really an account of this story, or is it about something else? Now, we don't have time this morning to work through those seven verses one at a time, but there are some things here that should be considered, and those will good memories will recall of what has been shared in previous sermons a few years ago. So the passage here indicates that the sons of God married the daughters of men. And the word married is probably not the word one would use to describe such an illicit relationship. Along this line, Jesus pointed out that angels don't marry and they don't reproduce. And so how did all of that actually work then? Did the angels procreate without the use of natural bodies? Or did they create for themselves natural bodies by the use of some mysterious, intrinsic, but rebellious power? And this power then produced life-giving sperm? I mean, all this just seems a bit fantastical. And it would be a bit odd to refer to fallen angels who rebel against God as sons of God. And the Nephilim, these so-called giants, perhaps they were simply humans who possessed genetic information for great height and strength that is no longer found in our gene pool. We should not automatically assume that the only possibility for that is a supernatural parentage. In fact, the Nephilim reappear later in the Old Testament, long after the flood. In Numbers 13, long after the flood, are we to conclude that another set of angels left heaven and united with human women in the same way again? And why would the human race be wiped out because of the sin committed by the angels? If this account in Genesis 6 is about angels forsaking their God-ordained domain in heaven and committing sexual sin with human women, then we would expect something to be said about their judgment. But nothing is said. Instead, the judgment of Genesis is all on mankind. And animals are wiped out, everything's wiped out, but nothing is said about angels. No mention at all about judging and punishing them in that passage. And we would have to kind of actually wonder about the motivation for all this. The passage is quite clear about what drove these sons of God, whoever they are, to marry the daughters of men. It was because the daughters of men were beautiful. And I don't know, I mean, it's just difficult to imagine the whole horde, a whole company of spirit beings who have no sexual functions or desires would experience this physical attraction toward the physical beauty of a human woman, so much so that they would all forsake their celestial glory so that they could marry them. It's just difficult for me to accept. I mean, really, were they that beautiful? And, it's a bit hard to accept, has led to other ways to explain that passage in Genesis 6. And there are at least two other possible options. And they should always be part of the discussion. So let's take a quick look at them. One popular school of thought suggests that the sons of God in Genesis 6 refer to those who were descendants of Seth. They were the ones, not the descendants of Cain, who were part of God's covenant people. And according to Genesis 4, they called themselves by the name of the Lord, that is, sons of God. And after Cain killed his brother, he traveled to the land of Nod on the east of Eden. He married, had children, founded a society that was in opposition to God, which included acts of revenge, murders, polygamy, and all sorts of stuff. And the descendants of Seth, in contrast, are therefore referred as the sons of God in verse 6, where the descendants of Cain were referred to as the daughters of men. So this view, which is called the Sethite view, is not without its problems either. We're not going to take time to explore all that, but again, there are assumptions being made here, admittedly, but it certainly fits the whole context of Genesis 6 much better, because it just flows right from that whole thing in chapters 4 and 5. Those preceding chapters focus on the lineage of Seth and Cain, and the beginning of 6 just fits into that quite well. And so it does not require us to import all sorts of foreign ideas into that passage. Another position is that the sons of God refer to kings, nobles, and members of royalty. In ancient literature, such rulers were referred to as sons of a deity. That's how kings were referred to. And these kings, they lusted for power. They took wives from among the common people, forcing them to join their harems. And so polygamy was a big issue in all of this. The offspring of these kings and nobles could easily become men of renown. In fact, in Genesis 6, Nimrod, a famous early king, is identified by the same Hebrew word, Nephilim. And the Nephilim would not necessarily be physical giants, but more like great royal warriors. And this position, what is called the royalty view, is not without its weaknesses either, but like the Sethite view, it too fits squarely with the historical context of that time. So regarding all three views here, the fact is the verdict is still out, and may always be out. But there are different views here. There are things we know about this, there are things we think we know, and there are things we just don't know. And so any position we might favor about those early verses in Genesis 6 need to be held onto very lightly. And you might encourage others to do the same when you come across those who insist that they know what that passage is talking about. Nobody really knows what's going on there. And you should challenge anyone who claims that they do, because there are a lot of different perspectives here. So continuing on with this, outlining the problems of seeing Jude 6 as referring to angels who sin sexually, number 4... Another thing that seems rather odd would be the inconsistency in regards to the three examples Jude uses to press his point. If the angels sinned sexually, and they had this in common with Sodom and Gomorrah, who also sinned sexually, and this is the point that Jude wants to drive home in this passage, this first denunciation of the infiltrators, then why didn't Jude use an instance of an example of sexual sin in his first example? Certainly, there would have been plenty to choose from in the Old Testament. But his first example, as you will remember, deals with Israel's unbelief in the wilderness. And given the organization that we find in Jude's letter, even the organization of his themes, this would be a bit puzzling. It would seem that Jude would either list three examples of an identical sin or three examples where the sins were different, but they all nonetheless represent apostasy or radical disobedience. And I would argue that this seems to be the case. Number 5, when it comes to verse 7 of Jude, well, as we saw earlier, it can be understood in two or three different ways. You cannot rely on it for support for either position. And finally, there is another option here. The language in verse 6 could describe a rebellion of angels before the creation of the world. The Bible doesn't say a lot about this, but we know that something like that did occur. A number of angelic beings rebelled against God. We don't know why or what that was all about, but in so doing, they exchanged their proper place of serving him to serving Lucifer instead. In fact, this, I would argue, seems to be the natural conclusion one would come to when reading verse 6. So where does this leave us? We have three possibilities. From what I can tell, there doesn't appear to be anything in Jude or in Genesis or anywhere else in the Bible that would actually forbid one from subscribing to this theory that the sin of the angels committed was sexual. But at the same time, there isn't anything that requires it either. If that did actually happen, then we'd be left with trying to resolve all the problems that come with it. I think that there are a number of them. And I would be one who would favor the position that verse 6 is referring to a pre-creation rebellion of some sort. But this isn't something that I would raise my voice on when arguing about it, given that this is not an essential doctrine of the faith, and given that Christians through the centuries have held to various positions about that, then we need to hold whatever, you know, whatever we come up with here, whatever position we find to be the most compelling, again, hold it with a light grip. So verse 6 could be referring to the account in Genesis 6, a mass rebellion before creation, my vote, or possibly to something else entirely, but we wouldn't know what that would be. So the takeaway here is that in the end, as stated before, the point Jude makes stands regardless of what the angels actually did. We know that they left their place of authority. We know that they rejected their domain of service. We know that they were punished for it and will be punished fully on the day of judgment. And in this way, they shared with the Israelites and with the residents of Sodom and Gomorrah, along with the false teachers that Jude is warning about, a common act of apostasy, a common condemnation, and will suffer ultimately the full fury of God's wrath. And this sobering message to Jude's readers is just as relevant to us as it is to them. You know, we are all guilty of libertinism, for instance, in some form. This is the problem in that church there, of exploiting God's grace and his willingness to forgive, of turning that into a license to sin. We all do this, unfortunately. And so let us, as Jude exhorts his readers in the verses to come, and we will get there, let us build ourselves up in the faith. Let us pray in the power of the Holy Spirit. Let us keep ourselves safe in God's love. Let us wait patiently for the mercy of our Lord Jesus Christ. Let us show mercy to those whose faith is wavering. And let us snatch others from the flames of judgment. And let us hate the sin that contaminates our lives. So next week, we are going to jump, you might say, from the frying pan into the fire. We have another strange passage ahead of us. Next one, verses 9 and 10, where we deal with this second condemnation of the false teachers, we have this bizarre story of Michael the archangel arguing with the devil. And they are arguing about the body of Moses. And so what in the world is all of this about? And in that, Jude warns about slandering and warns against slandering and blaspheming celestial beings. Okay, I promise not to do that. I mean, but who would be tempted to do that anyway? So what is really going on here? And I also hope next Sunday to tackle this third condemnation found in verses 11 to 13. There's five of them. I hope to do number two and number three next week. There we find the most colorful language, I think, in the whole letter. The infiltrators are called hidden reefs, waterless clouds, twice dead trees, wild waves of the sea, and wandering stars, and so on. So we got lots of fun stuff ahead of us, and we'll be covering quite a bit next Sunday, and so you might want to bring your lunch. So let's go ahead and have the musicians come at this time, and we'll stand, and a song we're going to close with, I think is appropriate. You might just kind of reflect upon these lyrics in the light of what we've been covering in Jude's letter.